You're listening to the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 169 for the week of April 25th, 2012.
This is the Experience Points Podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
My name is George Albor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net, a website created and dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And you know what we need before we get video games?
Dollar bills.
That money.
That crypto Benjamins, Scott.
So much money.
Yeah.
And we never really talk about it on the site, but
about crisp bills.
Yeah, I mean, we try not to make it rain that often. You know,
we do that when we're not recording ourselves.
Right, when we're swimming in our pools of money that we have in our respective houses. From, of course, all of the revenue we get off of the site, of course.
Yeah, I believe we call them cribs now, Scott.
The bottom line is, it's pretty expensive to play video games.
Yeah.
You know, whether we're talking about the hardware or the software, either way, to really invest in either a PC or a console and various other games, it's going to set you back quite a bit more money than a similar reading habit or, to some extent, maybe a movie habit, although we can discuss that a little bit later. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Chris Kohler over at Wired was thinking the same thing about a couple weeks ago. He wrote a post called "Video Games Can't Afford to Cost This Much," it's one of the more detailed analyses of what used games do to the market versus how publishers think of them and why people buy and sell the games they do. And you know, we'll link to it in the show notes, of course, but you know, this type of analysis on what do used games do to the video game industry in general? First of all, it's notoriously hard to measure. And second of all, it's kind of a lightning rod politically and economically for people.
Oh, yeah. People get real angry.
Right. And so it's cool to see Chris do a more in-depth story about this. You know, he takes a look at how games' budgets have been increasing over the years, what publishers say used game sales do, what consumers' habits manifest in the market, and mm-hmm. how GameStop tends to market its used game industry. And so there's a lot of different factors that he goes into, and it was a pretty comprehensive and thought-provoking thing. So we'll talk about that a little bit, and we'll also talk about, you know, a little bit more broadly our economic approaches to playing the games we play.
Right.
So I don't know, should we start with some interesting points of the article?
Yeah, and I actually think we should start where the article starts, which is the recent voting for Electronic Arts as the winner of the Consumerist's annual Worst Company in America.
Oh, yeah.
And this was really interesting, and I saw a lot of people talking about it on Twitter the day it came out. And I think a lot of people were blowing this out of proportion. Mm-hmm. The Consumerist's Worst Company in America is a reader poll, and so it basically asks internet users to vote on the company that they despise the most.
Yeah.
And whenever you're messing around with internet polls, you have to understand, of course, that your data is not going to be statistically significant.
Right.
People who are vocal about video games spend way more time online than people who don't get a home loan, for example, right, from Bank of America.
Right.
And so, of course, the data is going to be skewed.
Yeah.
That being said, I do think that it's significant. And more importantly, what's significant is the reactions to them winning the award, because mm-hmm. you got people who would say, well, they're not as bad as Bank of America, but no one was really coming to their defense. You didn't see people go, oh, no, hey, they're a great company, you know?
They're just saying, relative to, you know, Blackwater, they're pretty amazing.
Yeah, and even EA had an announcement that said, we're glad that we won this award or whatever, but we'll just keep making games that are incredibly popular, etc.
Yeah, there was a cheeky statement about, like, well, I'm sure BP is sad not to have won this, where, like, they're kind of acknowledging the fact that there are companies that do, you know, physical harm in the world much more than they do, but, you know, they're still kind of I don't know. It was a weird announcement, I thought. That was a weird thing in general.
It was. It is really weird. I mean, I'm glad that that type of award exists. I think it's, I mean, really, you should be having a group of expert panelists decide.
Right.
But that's a different subject entirely.
Yeah. And you know, that sparks a discussion as to why they were voted this way. And it's mainly because of their financial decisions and business models that they've been implementing. You know, the rise of online passes, the idea that DLC is not really downloaded, it's on the disc and you pay to unlock it. In the article itself, Capcom is singled out. There's been a kind of a controversy with Street Fighter versus Tekken where all the downloadable characters are actually, the data is on the disc, you're just paying to download them.
Right.
And so this all feeds into, you know, what games are worth what we should pay for them, and also how the used game, because, you know, the argument is because of the used game market, the companies have to do this sort of material.
Right.
Because they don't see any aftermarket money once people sell them back to GameStop.
And Kohler's main point with the article, and really his suggestion for solving the crisis of games costing too much and therefore causing all of these problems, is that we just need to lower the price of video games.
Right.
That games shouldn't be at a $60 price point, but maybe at a $40 price point, or be lower depending on the amount of content that they're providing to players.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a really interesting point, especially when we look at the things that are contributing to this, imagining that games are super expensive, or really more, that games are not worth the amount of money that we're paying for it. Right.
Right.
Because the concern with the Capcom thing, for example, is that people are saying, look, I put $60 into this game, and unless I get those 12 characters that are on the disc, you are robbing me. I am getting, say, $40 worth of content as opposed to $60 worth of content.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I see is it's really hard to figure out how much things cost, because no one says what their budget is.
Right.
No one talks about what, you know, like, of course the people making the game want to make a profit as well, right? Mm-hmm. What are their profit margins? What are their expected profit margins? What are their desired profit margins?
Yeah.
None of this stuff is clear to us. It's probably not clear to the developers or the publishers themselves. And so it's really difficult to figure out, well, what is the right amount of money to pay?
Yeah. And also just for the downloaded things, like, it's secrecy breeds contempt, because, you know, the way that game development works is that most of the time you have to finalize the game some months before the actual game is released to the public, because there's many different tests and different certifications based on what platform you're releasing for. And so there might be a good chunk of downtime where the dev team is just doing nothing.
Right.
And so they can start working on day one DLC type stuff that was actually created after the game itself was finished, but is now ready to launch on day one because the game had to be finished so far in advance of the actual release date.
Right.
And so, like, there's a lot of weird little quirks about just the way the industry functions that, because people don't really know about them and because companies aren't very forthright as to how things actually work, it's really easy to kind of breed contempt.
And you had brought up a good point before the podcast, that I think you were saying something about Mortal Kombat having problems by not having those DLC characters on the disc.
Yeah. Like, the matchmaking system for fighting games, most fighting games, the matchmaking system is pretty complicated. And Mortal Kombat had a problem where if someone was trying to be matched up with a person that hadn't downloaded the DLC characters, there was a real hard time resolving how to figure out who to match people up with. You know, like, if someone didn't have the downloaded Freddy Krueger, it would just basically kick them out of the multiplayer, because it needs to be an even playing field, basically. And so if that data lives somewhere on the disc, then, you know, you don't have to worry about that, because on the back end, the computer can see all that data, even if you don't have access to it.
Yeah.
And so it's like, there are, you know, there's practical reasons why that type of stuff happens as well.
Yeah. It always seemed weird to me, too, when people would complain that, well, this is on the disc, but if we didn't know what was on the disc, would we know that the value that we got for that $60 wasn't as much as it should be?
Right. Like, if you don't know you're possibly being cheated, are you being cheated?
Because the thing is, we judge the value of a game after we know whether or not we've been swindled. It seems kind of backwards. Like, to know that you've been swindled, you have to know the value of the product that you're playing.
Right.
And it's so, like, there's so much variety here, right? Like, The Darkness 2 came out, for example. That game's like 4 hours long. It's super short compared to something like Skyrim that came out for the exact same amount of money.
Right, right. And I mean, that's an interesting point that Kohler kind of, you know, suggests in an earlier part of the article when he talks about budgets just skyrocketing towards the, you know, first decade of the 21st century, you know, like around 2007, 2008, budgets just went out of control. Like, it just costs a huge amount of money because of how sophisticated the technology is, because of how many people work on teams. Like, it's just way more expensive to make games than it was. And game prices haven't really risen commensurate to how much the budgets have risen.
Right, right. So you're saying, like, well, you know, we used to pay $50 for a game, now we pay $60. That's a $10 increase. That's not all that much when you consider major AAA titles are going up by, you know, 5, 6, 10-fold in terms of budget.
Hundreds of people working on a game for multiple years, and, you know, the prices only increased $10. Like, it's, you know, it's kind of surprising. For me, I'm actually surprised that games are still as cheap as they are.
Yeah. And one of the problems, right, is because of that, you're banking on being you're selling a lot, right? That's the one thing. It's like, okay, well, the profit margins for each individual game might not be that much, but we have to sell a huge, vast quantity of them. And I think that's where you start getting people who become very paranoid about the used game market and about people pirating your game and whatnot. Because when success or failure hinges upon not just, you know, 100,000 people playing your game, but, you know, 40 million or something, things start to get real serious.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, that's when people, companies and publishers get seriously outspoken. You know, he talks about I forgot his name. It just went out of my head. The head of Ubisoft.
The THQ guy? THQ?
Oh, maybe it was THQ. What was
his? He said former THQ executive Richard Brown.
Right, right. Richard Brown, you know, very pointed words about basically, you know, the used market is taking away from their sales.
Right.
And, you know, when you have to make that many sales, everything that you see on the gray market seems like something that has disappeared from what you could count as your own.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think Chris Kohler does a pretty good job of diffusing some of those arguments.
I mean, he just flat out says that they're wrong with some statistical evidence that is pretty compelling.
Right.
He mentions that there's a suggestion that people who buy used games will sell their used games for and then buy other used games in this sort of endless cycle of buying used games and then selling them back and then buying used games again.
Right.
That's what Brown says, which is hilarious anyway, because there's got to be diminishing returns for the amount of money you get at GameStop for trading in used games.
Right.
But Chris Kohler actually brings up a report, I think from 2008 or 9, so it's a little dated, but that basically says the vast majority of people who trade in used games use that store trade-in to buy a brand new game.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, like, if they wouldn't be able to do that, then, you know, you don't have that the ability to buy even more new games. And maybe it doesn't work out well if you're Blizzard and they're selling back a Blizzard game to buy an active, you know, or a Ubisoft game or something.
Right. Yeah.
But in general, it's a pretty good thing.
Right. And, you know, and he also points out that GameStop itself has that business model set up. Like, and it's true. Like, I still get emails from GameStop exhorting me to trade in a few of my old games for this new game that's coming out. Like, that's literally what they're trying to do. Like, that they're banking on that economy. So either they're completely and totally wrong, or there's something to that, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, you know, GameStop, regardless of how you feel about the company, like, it's not dumb, you know? Like, if that wasn't working, they wouldn't be advertising like that.
Yeah. Because people still want new games. I mean, I don't do it anymore, but when I used to sell games back a lot, like, you know, first year of college or high school, I'd buy used new games. I'd you know, trade back three titles and get like $5, because that's how much you get. And then I would put that towards like a pre-order or something, you know? So it, in many ways, it allowed me to participate in the industry and not, you know, not miss out on things.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that I think some of the publishers lose sight of is that just because someone buys the game used, and Chris Kohler uses Brutal Legend as an example here, just because someone buys it used doesn't mean that they made that decision instead of buying it new. And I've done that before. There are some games where I don't really want to pay full price for them, but I'm still interested. I still want to experience it. I think Brutal Legends is a pretty good point. Like, there was some weirdness with that game. I never got around to playing it, but if I ever see it for cheap, I'll probably pick it up anyway.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's not, that new sale doesn't exist. I'll either never play that game or I'll play it on the secondhand market.
Yeah. I mean, you just picked up Demon Souls used, correct?
I actually, see, this is a good thing for this discussion. I picked up Demon's Souls 1 because there's kind of an artificial time limit for me because they're going to shut off the multiplayer servers on May 31st. So I wanted to get in it before the perceived value dropped. Like, if I bought Demon's Souls after the servers were done, it would be worth less to me because all of the features wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
And secondly, they made it a greatest hits title. And so I bought it for, and it was even cheaper because it was on Amazon. So I bought it for less than $20.
But new.
I bought it new on the greatest hits for less than $20 because there was something that's going to expire that I, you know, part of the package that I was paying for was going to be valueless if I waited too long.
Right.
And so there's like multiple threads in that one example. One is that I waited until it was something that I felt like I could justify buying. I bought it new because, you know, the publisher and Sony decided that they would be willing to sell it at a lower price with the greatest hits thing, which I'm totally fine with. I don't really care whether it's new or used. I just care about the price. Mm. And three, there's features that expire not because of any kind of social pressure or anything, but just because of technical reasons. Like, they're going to shut off the servers. You won't be able to get parts of that game anymore, regardless of whether you have it new or used.
Right, exactly.
So, like, that's another way I am imagining publishers will start limiting parts of their game. You know, like, there's going to be time-based incentives. Like, you should buy this game within the first month because there will be special quest lines or something that will just go away, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe if you buy it early, you'll get the special quest lines and you get to pay $40 instead of $60, you know? Like, but you get that new game sale rather than the used one.
Yeah, that's almost better than day one DLC.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a lot of different models to do. And, you know, I think a lot of companies, the companies that are most vocally against the used market are the ones that are having the hardest time adjusting to kind of the new era that we're living in.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you never hear Valve complaining about it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Valve is a strange example, too, because as we've talked about before, you know, Steam is a form of...
It's DRM, you know. Yeah, it's a DRM, very, right. It's a very pleasant DRM.
And we're fine with that. And I think that's one of the important points to point out, right? It's not that we're necessarily patently against all forms of DRM. It's that the companies like EA, you know, like EA Origin, for example, which has received a huge amount of animosity, and in my opinion, rightly so.
Yeah.
Is incredibly problematic because people who are buying this game for a single-player experience are put behind all sorts of gates, and it's incredibly inconvenient, and it's such a pain in the ass just to play the game that you bought.
Yeah.
That it seems absolutely ludicrous to look at something like that and compare it to Valve and say, you know, and then to hear someone say, oh, and well, we're doing this to protect you, the consumer, you know, or we're doing this for, you know, for so that we can still make these games in the future. Well, it's like, you know, there's clearly enough evidence to suggest that what you're doing is a terrible idea.
Right. And there's other examples too. Like, remember all of Ubisoft's PC things where you had to have an active internet connection while you were playing it, even like a single player game like Assassin's Creed. You know, all this stuff kind of is a more of a punitive mentality rather than a value add mentality, you know? What did you think about the point of the new reality of the smartphone/tablet era and how that messes with our ideas of what a good value is?
Yeah, we've talked about it before because we chatted a bit about how much iPhone apps and game apps should cost, and there was a general consensus that this whole 99-cent model is undervaluing games, right? And when we talk about it, we tend to focus on the sort of metaphysical value, like the personal value, like we see them as trash or frivolous,
right,
because of their cost. But in terms of the actual value, I think there's a point to that same claim. And I think that's a legitimate concern, right? If everything is costing 99 cents, we start to make this presumption that the game didn't cost that much to make in the first place. Otherwise, mm-hmm. why would they charge only 99 cents?
Yeah. And, you know, the idea that there's something like the DS where games still cost like what, $30 or $40 or something like
and
that.
And PS Vita games are like $40, right? Yeah. And there's this assumption that like, oh, it's a handheld, so therefore it should be cheaper.
Right. But, you know, the runaway successes, you know, there's lessons to be learned there, you know, like the Angry Bird lessons or the, you know, anything that Zynga does or, you know, Triple Town is trying to do, you know, trying to do the, I don't know, I hate using this term, but it's like the freemium model, right? Like you get to play for free, but you can enhance your experience with certain types of monetary transactions. And that sort of stuff just doesn't exist yet for what we grew up as considering regular video games. And you know, I don't know, like it's something that I'm not sure that I would necessarily want to see, you know, in the next, I don't know, whatever, Uncharted or Assassin's Creed or something like that. You know, there's something nice about having that single charge for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's the experience.
I mean, that's probably here to stay, but...
What's here to stay? Like, the freemium thing or the...
No, I mean, probably both, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like we're very... Like, the prices of games are very tied to the reality that existed when the current console generation came out. You know, the Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3 are just, they're just not set up very well to do downloadable content. Mm-hmm. It's kind of jury-rigged onto it, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's clumsy. Like, it's really hard to buy things in-game. You get kicked out to a menu. Like, it's, the interfaces themselves are not really set up for browsing things.
I think that's partly explains the visceral reaction players have to day one DLC. Because they feel like, okay, now I've got to basically put in work to make my game whole. You know, there's this, and it's not just that DLC is maybe, or certainly day one DLC, people consider a foundational part of the play experience that you need to have it, otherwise you're only playing 80% of the game or what have you.
Right.
But I think it's also that they're being asked to do stuff, period. You know, like, you want to be able to just play. You bought it, you should be able to play it. And so people don't necessarily want to be pestered, one, to download something and go through the inconvenience, but two, also just the cost of it, right? Like, I just bought a $60 game, and you already want my money again?
Right.
Like, chill out. Give me a break, you know? There is still so many marketing campaigns to get us to buy games that, you know, we are a heavily advertised consumer base.
Right.
You know, I don't speak from any sort of experience, but I feel like, just anecdotally, maybe more so than a lot of other mediums.
Yeah, and I mean, the types of, you know, when we are watching video game trailers or reading about video game news, the advertisements tend to be video game related. Like, it's all very constant within the sub community.
Right.
Whereas if you are reading a magazine, there's a variety of different things. If you're reading a video game magazine or website, it's almost always video game advertisements as well. So it's it's constant ads that are specific to the medium itself.
Yeah.
But maybe, I don't know, I kind of want to push on just a little bit of our personal budgetary habits. Like, do you think video games cost too much?
You know, so this is hard, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because I really want to talk about what it means to make a game cheaper.
Yeah.
And it goes back to what I was saying in the beginning, because we just don't really know the cost of some of the games that we are getting.
Yeah.
You know, you see in a lot of reviews still, people complain about graphics, people complain about, like, audio design on occasion.
Right.
And if we're going to make cheaper games, those costs have to come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, like, things are going to have to be cut.
Right.
And maybe it's the graphics, and some people say, oh, well, that's fine. But, you know, there's a lot of people who play for shiny graphics. There's a lot of reviews that make it a fundamental point. It's like part of their, you know, 5 points score. One of them is graphics.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
And
the
fun
factor.
Yeah. And so, I don't buy that it's so easy to say, oh, well, we just need to make cheaper games. Well, okay. Right. But, you know, where are we cutting the costs exactly? Mm. What overheads are we okay with people spending?
Mm-hmm.
The other problem is, you know, there are games come out that are very short, say something like Journey, and people go, that is such a great artistic expression. I'm willing to spend that much money on it. I have no qualms about it. Mm-hmm. And so people will look at a game, and after they receive the value they get of playing it, like they play the game itself, then they justify how much money they spent. Right,
right.
That's great. And I'm glad people feel like they can support companies that they like and reward people for gaming experiences. But this means that we can't just pick something and say all video games are overpriced or underpriced, or, you know, we're right. all willing to pay more or less depending on the experience we're getting or yeah. we think we're going to get, you know?
And you only get that idea after you're done playing it.
Right. So, like, you know, I could say, yeah, games in general are too expensive. And I generally agree. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I don't, you know, something like Skyrim. I have serious doubts that you could make that game just as good for, you know, $45 or something like that.
Right.
You know, and at the same time, am I going to say, oh, well, I'm not going to buy The Darkness because it's only 3 hours. That's I'll only be willing to pay $35 for this, you know? Like, this isn't a bartering system. We can't really negotiate price in that same way. And Valve is cool because they've got sales and they've got all sorts of things where they can lower the price when they start seeing people's reactions to adjust the value of a game based upon its actual value, right? But it's something that's just so hard to measure. And I used to harp on this a lot on the podcast, but I think it's an issue of transparency. You know, we need to know how much this shit costs.
Yeah.
And one of the things I mentioned before the podcast is there's a lot of hidden costs too that I'm just not privy to, and a lot of players are not privy to.
Right.
You know, some games will make their own proprietary engine just for that game. That is a large sunk cost, and it's an initial cost. Mm-hmm. So people go, oh, well, this game could be cheaper if you just made it shorter. Well, not really. Like, the length is less of an issue in terms of its cost than is the initial amount of money you're investing in the game in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, if you, you know, you're making whatever, like the new Assassin's Creed game, apparently has like a brand new overhaul of the engine. Like, that must have been super expensive.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like, they could have just gone up to, you know, I don't know, like Epic or whatever, and be like, hey, we're gonna use Unreal, guys, you've won, you've done it, you know? It's like, which I'm sure would have been a lot cheaper, except that not even necessarily, because like the BioShock, like Irrational uses Unreal, but it's super modified. You know, it's like BioShock is running on a heavily modified Unreal engine.
Yeah, yeah.
And so like that'll like exactly what you're saying, whether your game's 100 hours or 5 hours, all that, it's just so expensive on a technical level right up front before you have anything.
Right. And so the Assassin's Creed is a great example, because the last Assassin's Creed used the same engine, used most of the same fucking assets, and was still $60. That game should have been cheaper, right? That's a ripoff. I'm okay with saying that.
Either that or the initial one should have been more expensive.
Yeah,
you know, precisely. Like, if you really can't make your money back, and like huge companies like Ubisoft have all kinds of strange ways that they make money. I mean, you know, the more casual and mainstream games, you know, all the crappy Wii mini games help subsidize huge blockbuster games.
Yeah, and that's a big deal, right? Because, you know, say, for example, the last Assassin's Creed, they charged $60 for it. But what if some of that money is going towards making the next Assassin's Creed not $60?
Right. You
know? Say, for example, if everything were to actually match the real value plus some given, say 10% profit or something.
Right, yeah.
The value of games might be all over the board, and that might actually be more disruptive than we imagine. You know, take the engine issue again, or any technological innovation issue. Innovating in technology is very expensive, and so people need to feel that, though, that they're going to recoup those costs. And sometimes they mess up. Sometimes they fail, and the technology doesn't work as well. But we want to reward innovation, right? We want to say that Unreal does not have a monopoly over engines in the industry. It's healthy for the industry to have diversity in terms of technology. But it's not always going to be visible in that game.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not always going to know that we're getting our money's worth. And I think this is where transparency is a really important issue. Because I think it is important to say this game is more expensive than it should be. Yes, right. I'm all for consumer rights. I'm all for that. But to make informed decisions about that without putting a, you know, blanket statement about everything, we need to get some data. You know, we need to know whether or not 40% of this person's budget was in designing an engine that failed or not.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, as the years have gone on, we've seen many, many changes in the way video games are marketed and sold and priced. do you feel like your spending habits and how you decide what games to buy has changed similarly?
Yeah, I think so. You know, like I don't buy a lot of AAA games anymore.
Yeah,
same here. I use Gamefly, so for the most part, like AAA games, I'm just renting. I don't keep.
Right.
On rare occasion, I'll keep them. Or occasionally, like Mass Effect, right? I really wanted to get Mass Effect 3. Someone bought it for me for Christmas as a pre-order, so I didn't even buy it, right? Like,
yeah.
I got that from someone as a gift. The thing I do spend money on, and probably too much, is downloadable games. So, you know, I buy a bunch of XBLA. Like, I picked up Fez, those Humble Indie Bundle deals sometimes I get.
Right.
You know, I spend probably over half my budget on in terms of actual ownership on games that are not AAA. And this mm-hmm. includes my, you know, Gamefly subscription fee. It includes buying, you know, shorter content, like something like Fez or, you know, whatever, some random XBLA game. But for actual AAA games, when I'm making my decision, it's pretty consistently based upon my previous understandings of that studio or my previous experiences with the, you know, predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, Mass Effect 3, I would not have bought if I didn't like Mass Effect 2, of course. But I loved Mass Effect 2. So naturally, Mass Effect 3. And Diablo 3, for example, is coming out very soon. I'm going to buy that game. I know that I'm going to buy that game. But I also know that I'm going to enjoy it, right? I'm playing the beta now. It's a lot of fun. I'm enjoying it quite a bit. I have familiarity with the Diablo franchise. So, you know, it's not... I feel like I'm making way more informed decisions about my AAA purchases, and all of my casual purchases now are almost exclusively indie games and, you know, Kickstarter stuff, things like that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's, I think that sort of habit that I share too is one of the reasons why the AAA space, you know, in addition to development costs just ballooning, you know, people have a certain expectation when they're buying something from EA or they're buying the next Modern Warfare or something. And so there's very little incentive to be challenging or kind of innovative or take any risks as to how the game actually is, because they need a bunch of people to buy it at $60, you know, for whatever, however they've structured their budgets, it's around the fact that millions of people will buy it at this price. And so it's like I've become more and more willing to spend a bit more money if a game takes a few risks, even if it fails. Like I feel okay spending a little bit more money on something like, you know, people were talking about I Am Alive recently, and it's like, yeah, that's kind of like, you know, the game's kind of janky, but it does some interesting things, and it definitely has some unique aspects to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of risk taking is a little bit more valuable to me than something that I know is pretty much a known quantity. Like, unless I really, really love something, like you were saying, like, you know, you're going to love the next Mass Effect. I mean, hell, I'll probably buy that next God of War game that they just announced.
Yeah.
You know, like, I mean, the reason why they make that God of War game will be pretty much the same as the last God of War game mm-hmm. is because they want people like me to buy it.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like they need to guarantee that, you know, at least a number of people will buy it just based on the reputation alone. And so it's just kind of this vicious cycle.
So what is the next game coming out this year that you might buy? Like, you're on the fence about it. You're not entirely certain, but it's possible for you to be convinced.
I don't know. What's coming out? I mean, that's the other thing. Like, I'm so bad at keeping up now because, like, I know things will just pop up on the internet or on Twitter, and there will be like a week of hype, basically.
Yeah.
And then it will die down. And then the game will be like $40. Then I might start thinking about it.
Yeah. Well, like, yeah. That's all sequels, of course.
Remember when people were all obsessed with Deus Ex Human Revolution? And like, they were obsessed with it for like maybe a good 2 to 3 weeks or something. And then, like, after that, no one talked about it. And then there was a Steam sale on it. And then everyone started talking about it again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's one of those things where there's no latent multiplayer aspect. There's nothing necessarily all that unique about getting to it first, you know?
Yeah.
So that's what's really changed in my buying habits over the years. You know, rather than lining up to be the first on everything, I'm much more willing to wait for some of those more well-known experiences.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. Is BioShock still coming out this year?
Yeah, supposedly. That's what Max Payne 3.
That's an interesting one. See, I can see buying that game. It's weird. It's the thing that Chris talks about in his article. Like, the number one reason in a 2008 survey why gamers traded in their old video games was the game is not very good. Yeah, you know, it's like they're just worried about having, you know, enough enjoyment out of it. And if they don't have enough enjoyment, at least they can kind of mitigate that cost by getting a little bit back.
Yeah.
And so Max Payne is kind of one of those interesting cases where it's like, yeah, you know, maybe because I feel like that game is going to take some risks and be something different, I might actually be more willing to pay full $60 for it.
Yeah.
However weird that sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
But like when the next Modern Warfare comes out, come on, $60 for that? Like, it's, you know exactly what it's going to be, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's weird. It's almost backwards, you know? Like the worse a game is, like, it, you kind of want to give it a little bit more money. Because, you know, it's doing something unique, you know?
Yeah, because at least they're trying something.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. It's very strange. And, you know, all this is skewed because we're so used to the App Store where we could get 60 games for $60, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, like, we're not, we, you know, throwing away money is not necessarily as much of a worry, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Being an informed consumer is hard.
First world problems.
Yeah.
What is, so are there any games for you, like, are you, are, is there something that you're on the fence on that will really depend on the price?
I mean, again, like with something like Gamefly, like if I'm on the fence, I'm just gonna rent it, you know? Right. I mean, yeah, I don't know, the BioShock, I guess, but I'll probably
buy BioShock's it. For sure, though. And yeah, it's kind of one of those, like, it's one of those exceedingly rare games that is both AAA, but also doing some really unique things. Maybe not necessarily from a mechanical perspective, but yeah, there are very few other games that deal with mainstream AAA games that deal with political philosophy.
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm because I buy, I guess you could say, not frivolously, but casually, I'll buy like indie games or cheap downloadable games. I tend to be more on the fence for those, the ones that cost like $15, for example. You know, something like Torchlight 2.
Right.
It actually has multiplayer this time. I wasn't a huge fan of the first Torchlight.
Right.
Which many people will be shocked by, I'm sure. But, like, you know, so maybe something like that. Maybe something like Orcs Must Die 2. You know, things that were okay when they were first released, and now that they're getting a sequel, maybe I'll get it. But
yeah. Well, plus you want to make sure that Diablo has some competition, right? Because, you know.
Well, that's the problem, is I'm just going to be playing Diablo until BioShock Infinite comes out. So, won't have time. Sorry.
So, prepare for all of our posts. We'll be playing nothing but games that we can get at the bargain bin, $5 at GameStop. And then we'll go a whole year just writing about Diablo and BioShock.
Yep.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I mean, I definitely think this type of conversation will be much, much different in about 5 to 10 years, because I think the publishers will start to try to go directly to the customer rather than launder their money through GameStop.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, you know what? Let us trade in the games back to the people who sold it. How about that?
I mean, it's something that I'm surprised. Well, I mean, Diablo's kind of going to do something like that. They're legitimizing the item selling system, and I'm sure they're taking a cut of whatever gets bought and sold.
Oh, for sure.
But it would be interesting to have, you know, let's say on Steam, you know, if you relinquish your right to play a game, you get a discount on the next game you buy.
Yeah, sure.
It's essentially the same thing as buying something used. Like, you're not making up your entire cost, but you're mitigating it a little bit.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the publishers will be able to control what the margins are, and they'll see that money rather than GameStop.
I mean, they sort of functionally do that when they have, like, you know, before Max Payne 3 comes out, they'll probably have a sale on Steam for Max Payne 1 and 2 for, like, you know, $3 a piece or something.
Right. Or they could do something where, you know, if you reserve it or something, you get
That's a pre-order bonus, though, Scott.
I mean, it is. But, I mean, like, that's a way, like, you know, they might never see the money for Max Payne 3 without giving away Max Payne 2 and 1.
Yeah.
Which is essentially a used sale, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Plus, you gotta get that bills to pay for the crystal, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, my chocolate fountain doesn't power itself. Like,
I mean, we didn't talk...
there will be changes afoot once the next generation of consoles roll out that probably will look a lot more like Steam, I think. In which case, we'll just, this will be something that we tell our grandkids someday. We'll be like, did you know, Sonny, that you used to be able to go into a store and buy a used video game? And they'll be like, Grandpa, used? What's a store?
As we're hiding in our bunker.
Yeah, yeah. Burying gold. All right, well, before the insanity takes over, we'll just wrap it up there. If you want to write in with your thoughts or suggestions, experiencepoints@gmail.com is our email address.
Also, experiencepoints.net is the website. Also, leave a review for the podcast on our iTunes page.
Gotta pay those bills, you know, iTunes son. Money that we get. That magical internet
I'm
money.
I'm so poor.
I can't buy BioShock.
Oh man.
Okay, until next time, everyone, take it easy.
Bye-bye. Every time we